But we are looking today at the Psalms. Now, we've seen the power of God in the Psalms. We've seen the loyal love of God in the Psalms. This week is going to be a little different, and yet not. This week we look at how those two attributes can possibly coexist in one God. Now, hold on to that for just a second, and let me take you somewhere. Before I go there, there's a theological term that I want to throw out to you that will serve as a nice starting point for our thinking on this lesson. The term is theodicy. It is defined as a vindication of God's goodness and justice in the face of the existence of evil. It works like this. God's all-powerful, sovereign. God's also all-loving and good. And yet there exists in the world terrible evil. How can God be all-powerful and all-loving and allow evil to exist? Or, maybe more to the point, some would say God is either not all-powerful or He's not all-loving. He may be neither, but He can't be both, and there exists evil in the world, so the pundits would claim. And thus a theodicy is an attempt to explain the apparent contradiction between those two coexistent elements. So two lessons ago, we saw God as powerful. Last week we saw Him as loving, not just loving, but as having loyal, committed love. And now we have to ask, God, why do You allow evil? Are You powerless? No. Do You lack love? No. Then why? Now, some of you already have in your minds a reason for this. My guess, if I were to ask you to explain this, you would give me your own theodicy. There are several theodicies that people have, but the one I would guess, if I took a poll, most of you would probably have a, quote, what's known as a free will theodicy. It goes something like this. One aspect of love is freedom to choose. God wants us to love Him, and in so doing, He gives us the option to choose sin over Him. And by this choice, sin and thus evil of all kinds enter the world. Freedom to love means freedom to sin, and thus we have, as a result of sin, evil. Now, how many, just take a poll of hands, how many of you, that's your theodicy? Okay? Now, that's been my theodicy too. Never doubted it. Didn't know I should. Then I go to class Thursday night, and there Dr. Glenn Kreider, professor of theology at the esteemed Dallas Theological Seminary, gives, quote, three slam dunk reasons why this theodicy doesn't fly. Now back to that in just a minute, okay? Now I'm really excited about this lesson, how these three lessons are coming together. I'd like to say that I planned these three lessons ahead of time exactly the way they are going, but I didn't. Now, maybe I should let you think that so that you think I'm really well organized and everything. You've probably been around just long enough to know that I'm not. But I want to give credit where credit's due. And I have to give credit to the Holy Spirit in this, the working out of the perfect timing in this. Now, I knew I was going to give approximately four lessons from the Psalms on various attributes of God. That much I did have planned out, so I was at least 4 weeks in advance on that. But each of the last two lessons, I wasn't sure until I sat down what specific attributes of God I was going to be dealing with on that week until I sat down to give that lesson. So, you know, 2 weeks ago I sat down and I began to read through the Psalms and say, Lord, what am I going to teach on the Psalms this week? And I began to, you know, the power of God, that really would be a good lesson on the power of God. That was my lesson. And then last week I sat down to prepare a lesson. I thought, what am I going to teach on this week from the Psalms? And the word chesed, you know, Dr. Allen, my Bible professor, had made a big point of that word, and I've known that word for many years, what it meant, but I'd never really done a study on the word chesed. And so I thought, that's a good one. I'll do that on the loyal love of God. Now, the one topic I did know I wanted to cover was on the imprecatory or the lamentation psalms. I didn't know when I was going to cover it, but I knew I wanted to cover that in here somewhere. I even told you that last week if you were paying attention. But it wasn't until Thursday night of class, not my Bible class, but my theology class on the Trinity, the very last lesson of the semester deals with this problem of evil in the world. And the term theodicy is thrown out. And he discusses it. And I go home reeling from his three slam dunks, thinking about it a little bit. Not too much, because I've got to work on my way home. I've got to use that driving time to memorize the Chalcedon Creed, which is required for my class. So I begin thinking about that. So I kind of put the slam dunks aside to worry about them later. So, now, it's not until yesterday I began to formulate my lesson, I realized, wow, this is a perfect placement for a discussion on the Lament Psalms, and more specifically the imprecatory Psalms, because those are Psalms that deal with evil in the world. And it hit me like a brick wall. God, you are good all the time, even in my lesson preparation. Look at this. I put the power of God, I gave a lesson on that, and then I gave a lesson on the love of God, and then I go to class and he talks about how the power of God and the love of God can't coexist with evil in the world, and that is the imprecatory Psalms, and here I am teaching them. And see how wonderfully this came together. Now, I could not have planned this that well, I tell you the truth. Don't get me wrong, I think it's better to plan than not to plan. I'm in favor of planning, I just don't do it all that well. Now, it's good to know that grace abounds even when I continue in the sin of unplanning. Now, of course, I have to say, should I continue in the sin of unplanning, the grace may abound? Certainly not. But God be praised for His gracious help in this nonetheless. I had to share that with you because I wanted you to see how God's hand was in this, hopefully. Now, I hope that this lesson will be of help to you. So here's the deal. How does God's power and His love not just completely squish out evil and push it aside? You see the problem with this? And now back to this lesson on the Psalms. Now I'm titling this lesson "Praising God in Troubled Times," and that's probably not a strong enough word. I could easily replace the word "trouble" with any number of much stronger adjectives like evil, reprehensible, awful, terrible. You get the idea. But I chose troubled in particular because I don't want you who are not right now experiencing the worst of the worst to think that this lesson isn't for you too. We all experience trouble in our lives. In fact, I would say it's probably fair to assume that nearly, if not every day, we all experience some kind of trouble in our life. If you think about it, it may be very small, maybe inconsequential, you probably didn't give much thought to it, but something happens surely every day that wouldn't happen in a perfect world, right? Now, not all trouble is sin-related, of course. The Bible talks about Adam's responsibility to work the ground before the fall. So work wasn't a curse. Not everything that we don't like is a curse. The weeds, the thorns, the pestilence, and all that are, but there's a range of troubles, the point I'm trying to make here. And I hope that this lesson speaks to minor troubles in your life as well. There's also big ones. And many of you have not experienced really, really big troubles yet, but some of you have. And there are some things in this world that you have to look at, and you can say nothing good about that trouble, except maybe, well, I'm glad it's over. And that's about as good as it gets. When a teenager commits suicide or is killed by a drunk driver, that's terrible. When a child has to endure a terrible bout with cancer, whether they live or die, it's horrible. When a mother or a father die before they are supposed to, those things stink. And they are awful, they are terrible, they are horrible. When a loved one suffers terribly a long illness and then dies, we say that's good because they're no longer suffering. And yes, that's true. You're right. We don't like the suffering. But death is not a good thing. God did not make death a good thing. Death someday will be gone. Now, Well, there's several passages that talk about that. Revelation 20. Death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. Now, if you want to get into theological discussion about this particular verse, we could say that death and Hades are reference to one element. That's probably true. But there's no accident that the word death is used here, because at some point in time, death has gone away with. That's a good thing. Poof. Revelation 21:4. More specifically, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. We don't like sorrow, we don't like crying, and we shouldn't like death either. Death is terrible. At some point in time, it goes away. Hebrews 2:14. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him. Now we could say the death of Christ was a good thing because it brought about the opportunity of life to mankind. That's true. But you don't see the Father speaking to Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane and saying, "Hey, Jesus, look on the bright side. It's only a short thing." The death of Christ was not a good thing. It brought a good thing. It was a necessary thing, but it was not a good thing. Now, I know that we need to distinguish between dying and death. And so maybe dying is the thing we like to avoid. But it's still true that death stinks. It's not God's ideal, and it's not the way it should be, and it's not the way that it will be someday. Christ died so that we no longer are held by the devil who wields the power of death, that he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lives subject to bondage. Satan has this power. And by Christ's horrible death, again, not a good thing, but something that he did, that did have good results, that through the horror of the cross, we're no longer subject to the fear of death. Of course, you still die, unless, of course, you're fortunate enough to be raptured, but there's no longer a fear of dying. But death is not going to be something that lasts forever. The very last enemy that will be destroyed is death. And that's a good thing. Death gone, it's the very last enemy. And of course, this is another very important passage, a continuation of the same passage. So when this corruptible is put on incorruption, when the mortal has put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. Now, today we say you're going through this battle, this dying battle. Sometimes, you know, we would all like to experience a very short dying experience. I think we would all like to say, boom, it's gone. No one wants to think about a long, drawn-out battle. But it is a battle, nonetheless, no matter whether it's short or long-term, because there are always losers in the deal. The people you leave behind, it stinks for them. It's just plain terrible. And God will someday do away with death. Now, I understand that death is swallowed up in victory, so we can talk even today, while death still exists, about there being a victory in death. And we should be grateful for that. I don't mean to diminish that in any way, shape, or form. But the fact of the matter remains that death stinks. Death itself stinks. And it brings us back to our problem in the passage, or in the dealing with the Psalms. God is all-powerful. God's full of loyal love, and yet death and all sorts of other evils still exist at the same time. Now, before I go any further, I want to say this. I do not plan to solve this problem for us today. I know that that's where you maybe thought I was going, but I'm not. I told you that my free will theodicy was shaken up a little bit the other night. It's not dead, in my opinion. Slam dunks. I think the goal is a little higher than the professor was insinuating. But I do need to think this through a little bit more before. I'm not even going to tell you what his slam dunks are. So maybe someday I will. But if you expect to get an answer to the problem, you might as well just get up and leave now, because I'm not going to get there much today, and so you're going to be wasting your time. So I'll go ahead and turn around and give you an opportunity to leave. I'm going to leave. I won't know. Okay, good. Okay, now hopefully that was fast enough for you. I will say this. It's a serious problem. It's Christianity's greatest bane. Now, I don't mean Christianity produces the bane. It's the biggest, quote, blow against Christianity. It's the biggest problem we face, honestly. It may be more of a problem trying to solve it, though, than not. In other words, it may be better to get to a point where we say, Lord, I trust you in this than to try to figure out exactly why God is doing it. But that doesn't necessarily help people when they're going through the problem. Case in point. We know someone that professes to be an atheist. Now, this same person, though, has made some rather strange remarks about someone they knew needing to be saved. That's odd. Very odd language coming from an atheist. Well, recently this person told us that the reason they couldn't believe in God was because not too long ago their brother had committed suicide, and to believe in God would require this person to believe that their brother was in hell. And that was too much for them to take. Now, aside from maybe a bad theology that holds that a person who kills himself goes to hell, and I don't know if that's necessarily what their belief was, but that doesn't help even getting rid of that. The fact remains that evil in the world is a real problem that keeps real people from the faith. And it's a real tool of the devil. In fact, there's a book that was published not too long ago, which is a collection of stories about born, professing, evidently solid, born-again believers who have become professing atheists because they couldn't deal with evils in the world that they had personally experienced, and they couldn't justify God's power and love coexisting with those evils. They couldn't deal with it. So there are people who avoid God because of evil, and there are people who leave Him for the very same reason. This is very important stuff. And that's the longest introduction to a subject I've ever given, so please forgive me on that. But I believe you needed to get that background before we looked at these Psalms. Again, though, I'm not going to give you a theodicy, a reason, a justification, or a vindication for evil, but I will talk a little bit about it. Now, before we go any further, I'm going to ask you to have your Bibles handy this morning. It may be helpful. When I was preparing this lesson, and I typed that note to myself to remind you of it, it was going to be absolutely necessary. So it won't be absolutely necessary for you, but it will be helpful, I think. Now, what I want you to do, though, is to turn your attention to the Psalms of Lament. Now, these are Psalms that say, Lord, what is the deal? God, why are you doing or not doing this? Yahweh, why do you ignore our plights? And more specifically, we're going to be looking at the imprecatory Psalms. These are the Psalms that say, God, here's an evil, now go fix it. But the problem is, these Psalms don't address the evil in a general sense. Instead, they usually address it very directly. Lord, strike down this enemy of mine. And what's really shocking is that sometimes they do so with such stark boldness as to cause us as the reader to think that the psalmist himself is requesting the evil to be done. Look at this verse, for example. O daughter of Babylon, who are to be destroyed, happy the one who repays you as you have served us. Happy the one who takes and dashes your little ones against the rocks. Now, all kinds of people have danced around this verse, and they say, well, this is talking about, this is just prophetic. It's just saying this is what's going to happen. But that doesn't help us with the word happy in there. That doesn't really solve the problem to say that this is prophecy, because you can't get rid of that word happy. Others have said, well, this verse shouldn't be in the Bible. This was added by someone. This can't be inspired word of God, because it goes contrary to everything else in the Bible. Now, it's my opinion that this should be in the Bible. It's my opinion that, yeah, this is certainly prophetic in a sense. Babylon was destroyed. But this is not just prophecy. This is someone who's speaking from their heart about a horrible thing that they wish to happen to someone else. And so we'll have to talk about that a little bit. I'm not necessarily going to solve that for you, but before we deal with that, we need to step back a little bit and ease into this a little bit more, a little slowly, all right? So I gave you the worst of the worst right here, And then we're going to look at it introduce it a little bit more gradually. There are a couple things I want you to be aware of here. First, the psalmist in these passages addresses the Lord with very bold words. Watch this. This is from David. Listen to what I say, Lord. Carefully consider my complaint. Now you almost definitely have a different translation here. I chose the NET translation of this specific passage for some good reasons. But no matter what translation you have here, there's no way to make these statements questions or otherwise less straightforward than what David is saying. He's not just saying, Lord, I'm requesting that you do something for me. Please do this. He's saying, he's as close as possible, he's just about telling the Lord what he must do. Now, I'm not going to say he is doing that, but it's just about as close to that as you can get. Okay? Now, I'm going to tenor that a little bit here, because as he goes on, you'll see something. He says, pay attention to my cry for help. This is just about a demand, okay? He says, my King and my God, for I am praying to you. And then he said, this is something that takes us back a little step from that. He says, Lord, in the morning you will hear me. In the morning I will present my case to you and then wait expectantly for an answer. Now, David is living in a time of Oriental culture. And in these cultures, if you speak to the king without him asking you to speak to him, the two things are going to happen. One of two things are going to happen. Number one, the king is going to say, death to you. Period. I didn't ask for you to talk to me, therefore you die. I don't care what you just said. Or the king is going to say, okay. I grant you that. Now, we know this from history. We know it also from the Bible. When Esther approaches the king without first being asked. A little bit later in the history, but same culture. She faces certain death unless the king decides to listen to her. David knows this. David knows this. Why? Because he's a king too. David is in such dire straits that he takes this chance. He knows when he approaches God in this fashion, there are two things God's going to do. God's either going to kill David, or God's going to heed his words. David's in terrible, dire straits when he does this. He makes the plea. Now, you'll note in these bold words, there are statements of honor and subordination still. You are my king and my God. He recognizes this. I am praying to you. The word prayer is a word that automatically has within it the notion of acquiescence, of honor, of lowering oneself before God. Now notice this contrast in verses 5 and 6. Okay, certainly, before we get there, though, verse 4, this is the key. Certainly you are not a God who approves of evil. Evil cannot dwell with you. Ah, this is the Odyssey right here. You see that? God, you are powerful. You are king. You are God. And God, you cannot approve of evil. But there's evil going on. And the psalmist, David, is being as bold, as straightforward as he can, to the point where David is saying, Lord, hear me or kill me. Because I can't deal with this otherwise. Now, then we get to this great contrast in verses 5 and 6 with the next slide. Watch this. Arrogant people cannot stand in your presence. You hate all who behave wickedly. You destroy liars. The Lord despises violent and deceitful people. So verses 5 and 6 speak to verse 4. Verse 4 is a general statement. You hate evil. You can't stand evil. Evil can't dwell with you. Here's some examples of evil. But this also, verses 4, 5, and 6, contrast the next verse. But as for me, because of your great faithfulness, I will enter your house. I will bow down toward your holy temple. as I worship you. David knows he can only enter the presence of the Lord. He can only stand before him because David is clean. He's innocent of the deeds that he's accusing his enemies of. David's not perfect. That's important to know. But he's innocent of these deeds. He specifically relies upon God's faithfulness. He specifically bows before God. So there is subjugation. There is honor that David is giving him. He's not just going boldly and saying, God, you will do this thing. But he's saying, God, if you don't do this thing, you might as well kill me. And that's the idea you've got to get from this. Verse 8 then shows that David's right direction. Lord, lead me in your righteousness. He needs to be led in this. This right direction, the straight arrow that he's to follow, the properly balanced scales of life, that's the idea of righteousness, right, are set by following God's righteousness. That's how he achieves this. And then verses 9 and 10 describe the enemy more fully. They do not speak the truth. Their stomachs are like the place of destruction. Their throats are like open grave. Their tongues are like a steep slope leading into it. Condemn them, O God, and here's the result. Now, verses 9 in particular speak about what this enemy is like. That those statements should sound familiar to you. You think of a passage that sounds familiar? In the New Testament. What?
Romans
3, exactly. Now, Romans 3, many of the lines in Romans 3 are quoted from Psalm 5 right here. I want to talk about this for just a minute. I'm not going to read Romans 3. You can go back and read that. I could point out some of the lines where they're almost exactly the same, but a lot of them are different. And what happens in Romans 3 is that Paul is describing the horrors of sin, the sin nature. We are all under sin. And he uses all these terrible words and descriptions of that, right? Now, what happens when we come to Romans 3 is that we take this as bits and pieces of various descriptions. We take it kind of as a catch-all of the sin nature. We take this as a, Ron, you should like this, a sin jambalaya. All right? We're going to take this, that, and the other. We're going to throw it into this soup. It's very rich. It's got lots of flavor, right? And we take this passage to just be a general statement on the nature of sin. I think, though, what happened is that Paul is quoting from Romans 5. In Romans 3, he's quoting from Psalms 5. But he's also quoting from some other psalms. And he quotes from Isaiah. And he mixes all these different passages together to form this one new description of sin. I don't think Paul's just going, oh, grab this one, put it in the soup, grab this one, put it in the soup, grab this one, put it in the soup. If you read carefully Romans 3, this specific passage, he's really carefully crafting this around different specific areas of the sin nature. So that would be a good study on its own. We're not going to take the time to do that. But Paul is being very careful in picking and choosing here, and he's building a very careful theology on the nature of sin, well ordered. Okay, so when he picks these specific things, they have some purpose to them. But But back to our passage in Romans here. Now look at the last two verses in Psalm 11, chapter 5, verses 11 and 12. But may all who take shelter in you be happy. May they continually shout for joy. Shelter them so that those who are loyal to you may rejoice. Certainly reward the godly, Lord. Take a shield, like a shield you protect them in your good favor. This David ends this lamentatory or imprecatory psalm on a typical psalm's high note. Again, contrasting here the sinful with the righteous. Contrasting those who cannot stand before God and His presence and whom God cannot stand before. Remember, he opened up. He says, Lord, I implore you to do this. Lord, his statement to the Lord is, the reason for his standing before God is this. God, you have an ideal that you live by. Lord, you cannot stand evil and you cannot stand in the presence of evil. That gives David credence to stand before God for two reasons. One, because God, that is God's philosophy, right? That is who God is. But number two, because God, David himself is not guilty of the evils which he is calling on his enemies or associating with his enemies. So in other words, God, I stand before you and make this statement, this case, because it's in your law books already. This is how you are, God, and I'm just reminding you of it. But secondly, I can stand before you, God, because I haven't done the things that I'm accusing my enemies of. Now, David's not perfect, but he has righteousness imputed to him through this. But in the end, he goes back to this great contrast with, they can't stand before you. You can't stand before them, God. But we stand before you in praise, in your loyalty, in your love, and we rejoice in you. Now, whatever David's going through here, we don't know exactly. But it is so difficult that he's willing to put his life on the line. And in the end, he stands before God in praise. Now, on the one hand, there's angst. On the other hand, there's joy. But you have to look carefully at this. It's joy with a reason and a cause. It's joy because the Lord defends. Watch what he says. Verse 11, "But may all who take shelter in you be happy. May they continually shout for joy. Shelter them." There's a reason they shout for joy. It's because they find shelter in him. Because the Lord defends. And there's a place that we have joy in. It's joy in God. Because Yahweh blesses the righteous and surrounds like a shield. It's not joy. David's not going, "Lord, I love these circumstances." He's not even doing, as we talk about, and sometimes we're not very careful in our language of, and I'm guilty of this myself. Sometimes we say, yeah, we want to thank God, not necessarily for the circumstances, but in the circumstances because of how he'll deliver us. That's true, but we get really be careful with our language on that, because it's not even, "Lord, so much thank you for this circumstance." It's really thank you in this circumstance, because there are just some circumstances that I don't think God expects us to be thankful for them, because God views those circumstances as evil too. He doesn't want us to endure those difficulties. When he sees a child going through some kind of illness, God doesn't look at that and say, "That's something you should be joyful for." He says, "Oh, that stinks. I'm with you. That stinks. That's not a good thing. There's nothing good in that. God can bring good from it. God can bring good even in that circumstance, but it is not the circumstance itself that God expects us to be thankful for. Certainly, we grow from it, and we want to not avoid that. Now, I need to talk a little bit about the pattern of lament psalms. And this is kind of... this. Should be helpful to you somewhat as you read through these different lament psalms. First of all, within the lament psalms, there are three elements, three pronouns that are pronounced. And the lament psalms will have one, two, or three of these pronouns that are emphasized. The I pronoun says, "Lord, I am hurting, save me." Those two elements come out. The other one is "you," and it's "you, God." "You, God," or "O God, hear me," and it's expressed in a number of ways. And oftentimes, those lament psalms will start out with the word, "O God," or "Yahweh, listen," or "Lord, hear me," or "God," you get the idea. And then there's the "they," and that is, "They did this, punish them." Okay? So those are the pronouns. They'll be pronounced, playing words there, throughout the whole thing. But then there's also a pattern, elements that you will find in the lament psalms. Now, you won't find it in this specific order. You won't find that all of these elements are necessarily in every lament psalm, but they'll weave throughout there. It's not rigid, okay? They don't follow an exact form. These are gentle rhythms with most of the laments, including most of these sections. There's an introductory cry. A scream to God sometimes. And it's, "Oh my God, Now, I don't use that term in the light sense that you will find in language today, where people say, "Oh my God, that's terrible." But it's legitimate to say, "Oh my God." And I don't mean that, again, in a light sense, but the psalmist says it over and over and over again, and it's appropriate to say, "Oh, my God." And this is not when you stub your toe, right? "God, what's going on?" Or, "Lord," or, "How long, O Lord?" Right? There's a confession of trust. It's often added to make an impact of the prayer more powerful, not necessarily for the person giving it to God. In other words, it's not like, "Lord, I trust you, therefore you're going to listen to my prayer." But it's more impactful for the recipient of this praise who's going to hear it elsewise. In other words, these laments are often very personal, but they're public also because we have them, and that many of them were sung in public ceremonies. And so the guy that's giving it gives it for an impact for you and I. A lot of times they quote scripture to God. "Lord, you said this." Remember? Or sometimes reminding when God has previously helped them. There are the petition, a prayer, or a cry to heaven, "Hear, arise, return, save, consider, punish." And then there's a vow of praise. "I know this about you. I will do this about you." Now, when there's a strong punish element in the lament, that lament becomes what we call an imprecatory psalm. And you're looking for these patterns will help you spot major sections of the lament and also help you understand sudden shifts in thought. Because sometimes you're reading through these things and he says this, and then all of a sudden he goes over here and you go, "Wow, where'd that come from?" So if you'll understand that there are these different ideas that are being expressed, you'll understand why there's a sudden shift. Now, there's a question, though, that arises when we get into some of the more difficult laments, like Psalm 137, "Happy is the one who takes and dashes the little one against the rocks." It still says, how is this right? See, this doesn't tell us anything about that, right? So we have to kind of think through that a little bit. But the word, we call those strong element, those psalms with a strong element of punishment, an imprecatory psalm from the Latin word imprecari, which means to invoke evil or curse. All right, that's one of those expensive words I got. Now it's free for you. $1,000 a class. All right. Now, these are not little stifling things. It's not, "Hey, he cut me off in traffic, Lord. Dash his children against the rocks." That would not be appropriate. Okay. Or, "Hey, she said this about me, and it's not true. Cut her hand off, Lord." "I don't like this, Lord. You must kill my enemies." That would not be appropriate. These are serious issues where the attack, watch this, is on them, in which the attack is also on God. David wrote many of the imprecatory psalms. Some of the imprecatory psalms are anonymous. Only a few are specifically non-Davidic. Okay? So David was a regent of God. He viewed himself as that. And if you attack God's regent, you attack God. Now we see this attitude clearly in David himself. Remember, he's dealing with Saul. Saul's out there. Saul's declared, you know, David knew that Saul was God's man. And even though Saul was evil, Saul's chasing around David like a madman, and there are times when David says, "Oh man, I have the right. I could kill him right now." And there's that time when David just basically touches Saul, and then he goes, "Lord, I'm sorry for doing this thing. It was wrong of me." You go, "My word, where'd that come from? I mean, come on, you should have just gone ahead and killed him, David, right?" But David says, "No, this is God's man. Even though he's evil, he's still God's man." And God, when you go against God's man, you're going against God. And it's clearly evident in David's expressions about Saul. So when David's talking about God, he views it the same way. In other words, David is God's man now. And when someone goes against David, he says, "You are going against God," and he takes that seriously. So you mess with God's assignees and you mess with God. Now, if you can say that, about your enemies, when they do something rile against you, and you can say, God appointed me to this situation, and you're going against me, then it's appropriate for you to say, Lord, strike them. All right? But most of us, I've not been in a situation yet where I'd feel comfortable with that, all right? Even as God's appointed man to stand before you and preach. David sometimes was making curses on Saul. Anyhow. All right. So judgment is left to God. This is the next point. Deuteronomy 32 makes it clear. Vengeance is mine and recompense. Their foot shall slip in due time, for the day of the calamity is at hand, and things to come haste upon them. This is part of the law. And nowhere in these imprecatory psalms does the psalmist say, Lord, this guy's evil. I'm going to go out and strike him dead. Doesn't do that. Lord, I'm going to go bash their babies against the rocks. Doesn't say that. Doesn't do it. He implores the Lord to act in judgment. It's a very important point when you're looking at these things and dealing with these things that are very stark. So when evil things are done, we appropriately respond. That's what we should do. When things happen to us that are evil, it's appropriate to respond to them with harshness. Now, you may be for or against the Iraq war, and you know all of the implications that go behind that, whether Saddam was really involved with the 9/11 and all that kind of stuff, right? I don't want to get into all that. But the fact of the matter is that on September 11th, that evil was done to America. Evil. And it was appropriate to respond back in some fashion, right? Now, it's not appropriate for you and I to go out and kill some Muslim people. But we allow the government to do that because God has placed the government in authority. Number four, the point I want to make is the final judgment, the ideas of judgment, and final judgment are consistent with Christian theology. The prophets of old foretold the coming judgment. They didn't say, Lord, don't let this judgment come. They said, judgment's coming, folks. And if you want to be, I'm just going to put it this way. You want to be on the right side of the judgment. All right? You don't want to be the one who gets the judgment. Now, here's something interesting I want you to think about. Jonah. This is an interesting twist. Hopefully you can follow where I'm going with this. At the end of the story of Jonah, we see Jonah sulking. Why? Remember? Huh? They responded to Jonah's statements. Hey, God's bringing judgment on you. And God's, why did they respond? Now, who is Nineveh? That's the city of what nation? Assyria. Now, this is an interesting time in history. Assyria, at this point in time in Jonah's life, had ceased their westward expansion. So they were not an imminent threat to Israel, but they were still, nonetheless, would someday be a threat, and it wouldn't be very long down the road. Now, so at the end of the story, God spares the Ninevites. Now, you could say, here's a case where God allowed a truly wicked people to be spared His judgment. You following that? Now, temporarily, at least for some purpose, He did this. We don't know exactly why, but we can be pretty certain of what would have occurred had the Ninevites been wiped out by God's judgment. Nineveh, capital city of Assyria, was huge. We know this from excavations. We know it from Jonah's descriptions of Nineveh. It took him, I didn't read it yesterday, so I don't remember. I think 4 days to walk through the city. It's a big city, right? And it's located near the head of the Tigris River. Remember over back? River Tigris and Euphrates kind of start out together and then they spread out like this. Euphrates is closer to Israel. The Tigris is further away and it's at the head of the Tigris River. So it's kind of away from Israel. It's not an imminent threat. It's a pretty good ways off from Israel at that time, and its expansion westward to conquer Israel didn't happen until about 50 years after the story of Jonah. But Nineveh was such a large city at the very heart and soul of Assyria. Here's the thing. If Nineveh had been destroyed by God at this time, it would have almost undoubtedly been the demise of Assyria. Almost no doubt about that. Certainly, it would not have conquered Israel when it did some 50 years later in 722. Now, I don't know what that would have meant. That's one of those great what-ifs in life. But I do know this. Assyria was left to do its terrible destructive deeds. It was left to continue on with terrible false worship of the god Asher, Anu, Bel, Sin. It was left to do terrible atrocities against humans, where they would burn children, they would impale their victims on stakes, they would behead them, they would chop off people's hands. I don't know how well you can see that picture, but this is a picture of Assyrians in particular impaling Judahites. Very specifically, the nation of Israel. God let them survive. God allowed them to continue in evil. And the allowance of that would ultimately come down some 50 years later and go right against Judah. Now, I don't know why God spared them. But it gets worse than the fact that God spared them is that God actually used that evil nation to judge His own people. And that was terrible. These are not pretty things that happen. Sieges bring starvation. They bring disease. They bring death. Children, mothers, fathers. It's horrible stuff. Nothing anyone should ever endure. Period. But God not only allows it, He actually brings it. Now this takes us back to our initial question. If God's all powerful, if God is all love, how can He allow evil? Now certainly, how can He spare a nation and specifically under His own control bring that nation down and let it bring evil on His own people? That takes us back to the Psalms. Okay, so here's all power, all love, and it doesn't necessarily squeeze out the evil. So we're back to the summary of the Psalms. Now I just want to bring out one more point about the final judgment here. Final judgment is consistent with Christian theology. The prophets foretold it. The book of Revelation displays it. 15 chapters that talk about God's constant judgment on the wicked. And so when the psalmist prays for judgment on the wicked, that judgment will finally and completely be brought to end in the end days. And then with exactitude and punctuation at Christ's return, boom, He wins. Then after the millennium, boom, He wins again. And ends it all, death and Hades are cast into the lake of fire. Judgment comes as a result of unrighteousness. Now this does not mean, and you're going to have to bear with me. I'm going to run a couple minutes late here, and then we're going to wrap up this lesson next week. This does not mean that all terrible things in the world are the result of specific sin. Nor are terrible things in the world, all of them, the result of God's wrath. Clearly, this is not the case. David makes this case. Lord, why are You letting this happen to me? I stand before You righteously. Remember that? That's very important we get that. David got it. We've got to get it too. But what I'm doing here may be a little confusing because I'm talking about two parts of evil. Okay? When we talk about bad things in the world, like a person falling off a ladder and breaking something, right? That's a bad thing. Shouldn't happen to people. It causes pain. And it seems like a kind of evil. But it's not a moral thing, right? It's just something that happens. Now, I may push you off the ladder. Hopefully that didn't happen. I wasn't there that day, so I didn't do it. That's certainly a moral thing. But that's an evil act. That's different than just evil circumstance. The result of evil is falling off the ladder. In the case of an accident, it's the result of global evil, a sin-cursed world, Adam's first sin still biting you. In the case of intentional harm, it's the result of a local evil action. The action is evil. The result is still amoral. You follow me? I may push you off the ladder. That act is evil. But you're getting a broken leg is in itself an amoral thing. The action was immoral. The broken leg was amoral. There's nothing evil in a moral sense about a broken leg. Okay? Terrible things that happen to us are not always our sins. They're ultimately caused by sin. But this is not a solution to our problem of God's simultaneous power, love, and evil existence. Here's the thing you got to see. God still allows bad things to happen, and He could stop it. Those children, the Israelites, when the Assyrians come down, there are 2, 3, 4, and 5-year-olds. Now, I know that 2-year-olds are not perfect. I know, wink, wink, that 2-year-olds have a sin nature. Not from my own children, but I know it from others. I really know it from my own children as well. But those children did not deserve this. I'm certain of that. And when we talk to people outside the faith, this issue does not go away by talking about sin in the world. God is still on the hook for this in some way. Now, I'm not saying God's responsible. It's not His fault. God doesn't cause the evil. I'm using careful wording. But He's still on the hook because God is perfectly able to stop this from happening. And He's powerful and He's loving, but He doesn't stop it. And that's a terrible place to end. But I'm out of time. So we have to. We'll come back next week. Lord, we love You. And all I can say today is that we trust You. We know that You are all powerful. And we know that You are all loving. And no theodicy in the world can fully explain Your actions. But that doesn't keep us from trusting You. Because we know that You are good all the time. And so I pray that You will help us, even though I ended a terrible spot today. But I pray that You will help us to realize, to remember, to think on, and to trust Your goodness and Your absolute righteousness in all things. We love You, Lord, and we want to serve You and to please You. We know that there are terrible things that happen, and we do implore You for Your help. But we at the same time want to trust You in it. And I pray for Your grace, I pray for Your mercy, and I pray that You will help us in the weakness of our faith. And I pray these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.